these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Ebb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, it is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the 8-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told journalists this week he wants to be more involved with the deployment of U.S. nuclear weapons to defend his country from North Korea.
We have not seen any results yet, but South Korea and the U.S. will cooperate in the system, which the U.S. has been operating unilaterally. Although nuclear assets are U.S. assets, South Korea will participate in their operation, and the two countries will work together to respond to the threat of North Korea's nuclear escalation.
President Yoon has resumed large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea war games and strengthened Seoul's alliance with Washington. However, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far stopped short of coordinating the deployment of nuclear weapons. The U.S. has conducted several missions to South Korea involving so-called strategic assets, weapons that can deliver nuclear bombs. Amid the South Korea-U.S. military buildup, civil society leaders meeting in Seoul this week called on President Yoon to make greater efforts to pursue dialogue with North Korea. Under the previous progressive president Moon Jae-in, engagement with North Korea reduced tensions, which have only flared up again with the election of President Yoon and renewed North Korean missile tests in 2022. South Korean peace activists say 2023, the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, marks an occasion to increase their campaign to officially end the war. Meanwhile, President Yoon plans to celebrate the 70th anniversary of the South Korea-U.S. alliance with record-level military exercises. Frank Smith, Seoul.
They took months to be held, but only hours to fail. Negotiations between unions and the UK government aimed at working out mainly pay deals to prevent another wave of public sector disruptions.
We are talking about people who are working well beyond their contracted hours anyway, just to get the job done, because they can't hand patients over and because they care so much. So for the government to be talking about productivity in exchange for a pay award is an insult to every single one of our members.
An insult to his union members and perhaps to other public sector workers across the country, protesting against the government's refusal to give them pay rises that keep pace with inflation, which soared above 10% in October last year. The same month, public sector pay in real terms hit a 19-year low.
Brexit has destroyed investment. it's led to us being a less place, attractive place for foreign direct investment as well. So, unfortunately, we've got a lot of self-inflicted wounds, plus Ukraine, plus, you know, fairly incompetent government.
But the government is digging in. Instead of making concessions, it has introduced controversial new legislation to Parliament designed to curb the impact of the strikes. Critics of the new bill are warning of the consequences.
Once you start sacking people, people are more likely to even go on strike together. I mean, ultimately, this is so much against the trade union movement, they risk a national strike over it, because trade unions will gang together to make sure that they have an impact and stop this kind of legislation.
Without the desired pay offers from the government, those walkouts are bound to go ahead, with tens of thousands of transport workers, National Health Service staff, civil servants and others set to take part in industrial action this month and beyond.
There are more strikes in the UK today than in more than a decade, driven by a cost of living crisis and a lack of inflation-matching pay rises. The unions are saying enough is enough, and that the only way for them to cease further industrial action is hard, cold cash. It remains to be seen if the UK government will be the first one to blink in this staring contest. Saeed Purizep, London.
Families of prisoners and their advocates have staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. Tel Aviv practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, and Al-Quds. Among those apartheid policies is the bad treatment of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners are suffering tremendously inside Zionist jails, and we pray for their release. My son was only 17 when he was arrested and has been behind bars since 1992. He's a freedom fighter who fought for the liberation of Al-Quds and Palestine.
Palestinian prisoners who are held in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers are all denied basic human rights.
Prisoners' advocacy groups are calling on the international community to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its grave violations against Palestinian prisoners.
Meanwhile, a workshop was held in the blockaded territory on how to tackle the dangers posed by right-wing Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir on Palestinian prisoners. The workshop was organized by Hamas's Wa'id Prisoners Society and the Islamic Jihad's Mujahid al-Quds Foundation for Prisoners. Attendees discussed ways of confronting threats by the extremist Israeli minister.
It's our duty to protect and fight for Palestinian prisoners amid the ongoing attempts by Ben-Gvir and the Zionist entity to pass a law that allows the execution of Palestinian prisoners as well as the deportation of Palestinian prisoners. We are facing a big Zionist project targeting not only the prisoners but also all aspects of Palestinian existence.
For decades, the Israeli regime has violated all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention.
The issue of Palestinian prisoners is at the core of the Palestinian cause. They are held in Zionist jails because they fought for the freedom of Palestine and have kept the Palestinian cause alive. Palestinian prisoners have played a major role in fighting the Zionist project that aims to empty Palestine of its indigenous Palestinian population.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to break their silence and help Palestinian prisoners. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
We will not be beaten. This is the title of a newly released documentary produced by Press TV. The documentary has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents collected and released by the U.S. media regarding domestic violence against women and the violation of women's rights in the United States. We Will Not Be Beaten tells the documented story of the high rate of domestic violence and physical abuse against women in the U.S.
This documentary, ordered by Press TV, has been made based on 5,000 minutes of footage and documents regarding violation of women's rights and violence against women, which have been collected and released by the U.S. media. Also, in order to have a better understanding of the situation in the United States, we have interviewed many people who have been living in the U.S. for 10 to 20 years.
According to official statistics, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines in the U.S. every day. Moreover, one in every three women in the U.S. experience rape and physical violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime.
This documentary has shown the realities regarding violation of women's rights and domestic violence against women in the United States. It shows that the only thing that the U.S. does not care about is the rights of women. One example is the U.S. proposed resolution which led to the ouster of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. The production of such documentaries will further shed light on the double standards policies of Washington with regard to women's rights.
While Western media outlets have launched a propaganda against Iran with regard to the status of women, we have released a new documentary titled We Will Not Be Beaten to depict the true status of women in the U.S. As Press TV has been the voice of the voiceless, we have made our efforts to be the voice of the rising number of American women who are facing domestic violence and physical abuse on a daily basis.
Domestic violence against women has seen an alarming uptick in recent years in the United States, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. A report by the Council on Criminal Justice found that reports of domestic violence in the U.S. have jumped by over 8% during the pandemic lockdown.
As Press TV documentary has shown, the high rate of violence against women in the U.S. has been recognized as a public health concern, with media in the U.S. contributing to making domestic violence appear unimportant to the public. Experts say, given such realities on the ground, the U.S. cannot serve as a role model for women's rights in the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records. Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million. In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, you know, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Braving the bone-chilling weather, mourners are remembering those who gave their lives for the future of this region and beyond.
These people gathered here to pay tribute to martyrs to the war against the key terrorist groups in the region who were backed by the U.S.
General Qasem Soleimani was remembered as a hero for humanity who transcended geographical and ethnic boundaries and whose campaign against the Daesh terrorist group saved every Muslim and non-Muslim country, including Pakistan.
Mati Qasim Soleimani is a way of life and a school of thought to fight the enemies of the Muslim world and the East. If the world of Islam and countries in the East want to save themselves from the malicious designs of the West, aimed at breaking this region into pieces to create its new world order, then they have to follow Qasim Soleimani and the strategies he used to save the West Asia region from the collapse.
Speakers at the gathering shed light on different dimensions of martyr Soleimani's life and his legacy, as well as how it impacted the region.
The U.S. and its Western allies had remained helpless and in despair in the face of global terrorism. Martyr Qasim Soleimani put an end to the darkness of this hopelessness vis-a-vis U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorism.
Some 70,000 Pakistani citizens have been killed at the hands of U.S.-backed Takfiri terrorists, including in attacks on schools and children. These were the same terrorists that General Soleimani took out in an anti-terror campaign for which he will always be remembered. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The two-year anniversary of the election integrity protest, which burst into Congress on January 6, 2020, has been overshadowed by Congress's historic failure to select the third most important post in the country, the Speaker of the House of Representatives. After more than a dozen votes, mainstream Republican Kevin McCarthy finally won a majority, ending the total paralysis of the new Congress. However, the embarrassing stalemate was the worst of its kind since before the American Civil War.
Both of them just show how American politics is dominated by spectacle and political theater, while Americans who are suffering through terrible economic hardship right now and are politically polarized are just sitting on the sidelines while all this plays out.
As the speaker chaos continued, Democrats demanded attention for 2020, while Republican lawmakers largely ignored the anniversary. The stark difference isn't surprising. Polls have long shown that 35% of the country still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% still calls it an insurrection. The subsequent January 6th committee to investigate the incident was either branded a political show trial and witch hunt or a necessary defense of American-style democracy.
It should have been a bipartisan inquiry, a serious one, into what was, you know, supposedly this, you know, vast constitutional violation by Trump and his campaign and his administration, and it's just become this endless commercial for the Democratic Party, which is totally bankrupt. And 2 years later, they're still using it to, you know, try and get themselves elected.
While Washington is repeatedly faulted for encouraging protests in other countries, almost 200 January 6th protesters have been sentenced to prison terms. Seemingly every participant has been publicly hunted down, which may serve as a chilling effect which forestalls future protests. Has Washington's response to the controversial events of January 6, 2020 reduced conflict, division, and disunity? We cannot ask Congress, because just like 2 years ago, they cannot meet in peace. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The limelight.
The end to the fabricated regime of Israel has long been started with the fact of reverse migration into effect. A new movement to leave the occupied Palestinian territories called Israel after the recent elections is part of a long tradition of disillusioned Jewish occupiers and colonies departing the Palestinian land. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the Zionist newspaper Ma'ariv reported recently on a new movement whose goal is to facilitate the emigration of Israeli Jews to the United States following the recent Israeli regime elections, which, in their view, alters the Zionist regime's relationship to religion. The group, which calls itself Leaving the Country Together, plans to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its plan. Leaders of the group include Israeli anti-Netanyahu activist Yaniv Gorelick and Israeli-American businessman Mordechai Kana. Kana, who has historically been active in bringing Jewish colonists and occupiers to Palestine, told the newspaper, "After years of smuggling Jews, I decided to help Israelis to make aliyah to the U.S. It is time to offer the Zionist movement an alternative in case things in Israel keep getting worse." The departure of Jewish occupiers from Palestine is hardly a new phenomenon and is in fact as old as the Zionist Jewish occupation of the country, which started in the 1880s. At the time, Jewish occupiers from Ukraine, members of the Kharkiv and Odessa-based Bilo movement, left Palestine after being disillusioned with the results of their colonial efforts to the U.S. and back to Russia. Indeed, between 1880s and the First World War, a majority of the Jewish occupiers who had arrived in Palestine in the interim left the country. As much as 10%, about 60,000, would leave between 1920s and 1948, in addition to 30,000 who left prior to the British conquest. According to Zionist researcher Meir Margalit, thousands more colonists wanted to emigrate but did not have the means to leave. Thousands more appealed to the United Nations after the Second World War to be included on the list of refugees entitled to return to their homeland in Europe, similar to the displaced persons scattered throughout Europe. The Palestine-based Organization of Returning German Immigrants demanded that the UN help them go back to Austria and Czechoslovakia. In 1947, Jewish occupiers submitted 485 requests for an Austrian passport, while the Polish Consul in Tel Aviv reported that 14,500 Polish Jewish colonists requested visas to return to their homeland. Although Zionist leaders would conspire with the Poles to create endless delays in processing requests to dissuade would-be emigrants. After the Zionist regime was established, emigration was still a feature of the Jewish colonies' experience in the country. But between 1948 and mid-1950s, 10% of the new colonists and occupiers had also left Palestine. Concerned about the failure of its settler colonial project to keep the Jewish colonists in Palestine, the Zionist regime introduced severe restrictions on their emigration from 1948 until 1961 by requiring an exit visa, which was often denied. Despite such restrictions, by the 10th anniversary of the founding of the fabricated regime of Israel in 1958, 100,000 occupiers had left. By 1967, more than 180,000 Israelis, most of them Jews, emigrated. Obstacles continued to be placed in their way by the Zionist regime in 1960s and beyond. Still, by 1980, as many as 500,000 Israelis were already emigrants in the U.S. alone. By the end of 2003, the Zionist regime estimated that more than 750,000 Israelis were living outside the country permanently, the majority in the U.S. and Canada. In more recent years, it is estimated that the 600,000 to 750,000 Israelis living in the U.S., 230,000 were Israel-born Jews, meaning children of Jewish immigrant colonies born in occupied Palestinian territories. Between 1948 and 2015, the Zionist regime claims 720,000 Israelis emigrated and never returned. White colonists across the settler colonial world have opted to either go back to the European mother countries as French colonists in North Africa, Portuguese colonists in Angola and Mozambique, although a good number went to Brazil, and British colonists in Kenya had done. Others moved to Australia, Canada, the US. Already in 2016, it was estimated that up to 30% of French Jews who emigrated to Palestinian-occupied territories ended up returning home to France, despite intense efforts by the Zionist regime and Zionist groups to attract them and keep them in the settler colony. The significance of the new movement leaving the country together is that it is the immediate outcome of the most recent accession to power of a new Israeli cabinet. For the Palestinians, the Zionist regime has been, since its founding, a racist regime and, most importantly, a settler colonial one. Nonetheless, most Palestinians certainly hope that the Leaving the Country Together group is a good harbinger for the final decolonization of their country in the near future. According to a report published in Al Mayadin website, a report by Israeli journalist Noam Devir for Israel Hayom revealed that Israelis are concerned by societal rifts and the rising cost of living, according to a poll by the Penima movement, which is working on addressing the rifts in the Israeli society. According to a report, around one-third of Israelis, about 35%, said the occupation is not treating bereaved families properly, adding that 60% of Israelis aged 29 and under were of that opinion. The poll's findings show that 33% of Israelis have thought of reverse migration over the last year. 66% of Israelis aged between 18 and 24 said they were thinking about leaving, compared to 53% of Israelis aged between 25 and 34. As for the issues behind their thinking of moving, 40% said the reason was the high cost of living, 22% cited the security situation, and 18% said societal rifts. 43% of Israelis living in Tel Aviv said they were most concerned by the rising cost of living, while those living in occupied Alot said they were concerned by societal rifts. The former Minister of Internal Security of the Zionist regime occupation, Avigdor Kahalani, stressed recently that he fears the fate of Israel after one generation, adding that internal problems will destroy Israel. Kahalani said in a cultural seminar with journalist Roy Katz in occupied Beersheba that Israel is not prepared for what is to come, and in 10 years, the situation will be worse. He mentioned that the guns aimed at some other countries must be first be directed to the inside, that is, at Israel, because today it is deteriorating, expecting pedestrians to start holding guns, according to the former minister. Kahalani stressed that the political circle in Israel is thinking of its narrow interests only, and that every party thinks of ending its mandate peacefully. He believes that the Israeli regime is so preoccupied with its survival that the long-term plans are neglected, expressing worry for the fate of the Zionist regime.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The new extreme right-wing Israeli cabinet has started its work with some controversial and provocative moves, although it has assumed power for only about a week. The visit by the hardliner minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier this week drew widespread condemnations from not only the Muslim world, but even the U.S. The same minister has visited Nafa prison today to make sure the conditions of the inmates have not improved and that they don't have, quote, excessive rights, a move that Hamas has slammed as an unprecedented criminal act. The Tel Aviv regime has also issued financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. We'll discuss these issues in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. And also Lebanese journalist Sandas Al-Assad joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off with Mr. Barrett in Madison. The United Nations Security Council has voiced concern about the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound following this provocative visit by the Israeli minister. That's just more platitudes and no action. Why did the Security Council yet again fail to act against another Israeli violation?
Well, the UN Security Council has been running interference for the Zionists for quite some time. Even though the Zionists are the biggest international outlaws and criminals, the violators of the most UN resolutions of any country on earth, they're still given a pass. And probably a lot of the reason for that is that they have so much power in several of the countries that make up the Security Council. So we shouldn't expect the United Nations to solve this problem, certainly not the Security Council as it's currently structured. If it were changed and restructured and became more reflective of the world's population, then that might change. But as it stands right now, this most extreme Israeli government in history, with people like Ben-Gavir, who basically worships Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the Hebron massacre, a serial killer and maniac. And Ben-Gavir used to have a big picture of him on his wall that he bowed to, I guess. This guy is a complete, there's really nobody. There's no genocidal maniac on earth today that you could find that could really beat this guy in the sweepstakes for that title. He's now taking up where a long list of other Zionist extremists have left off in terms of provoking violence by attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the oldest and greatest Islamic architectural monument, and trying to set the stage ultimately for demolishing it, as many of these maniacal, ultra-extremist, messianic, millenarian Zionists want to do. So he's taking up where people like Ariel Sharon left off prior to 9/11, when Sharon's job was to set the stage for the post-9/11 crushing of the Palestinians in the run-up to that Israeli demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. So these guys right now in this current government are just completely beyond the pale in terms of anything that even ultra-Zionists like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times can even imagine ever stomaching, and yet the United Nations and the international community are letting them get away with it. And it makes you wonder, what wouldn't they let them get away with?
Ms. Al-Assad, at the United Nations Security Council session, the Palestinian UN envoy said, quote, what red line must be crossed for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough? I think it's safe to say that many of those red lines have already been crossed by the Israelis on numerous occasions.
I believe that the United Nations is complicit in the atrocities that have been that are being held against the Palestinians. The United Nations, we have seen how the United Nations act with double standards policy regarding the issue of Iran, for example, the issue of Russia, the issue of China. They all the time condemn these countries while and sanction them, but they don't sanction the usurping occupation entity. So I don't believe that the United Nations will do justice for the Palestinians. The only thing that will do justice for the Palestinians is the righteous right of resistance. This is the only option that the Palestinians must hold, must uphold, because the Zionists are there's no a good Zionist and a bad Zionist. The old Zionists are occupiers, and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and to get rid of this occupation.
Kevin Barrett, the Israelis, as we've seen, act with impunity, as they are above the law. How has the insufficient international response and lack of action from international bodies, such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, and most notably Arab governments, contributed to this status quo?
Well, the international institutions are set up to fail. We don't have real international institutions now. What we have is a kind of a set of institutions, starting with the United Nations, that are fig leaves for the protection of power by the powerful. And for that reason, there was never any real intent to have these institutions enforce any kind of just international law. Instead, they provide cover, again, for, like, the U.S. wanted to wage a war in Korea, so they got the United Nations to approve the Korean War, and right on through the Iraq War, these other kinds of interventions. We always see that the United Nations is not representing a majority of the people of the planet. It's essentially just, again, providing cover for the biggest imperial and state interests. So the real question here is not so much why have the international institutions failed. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. But rather, why haven't any national governments tried to do something about this? And the first national governments that we would expect to stand up for the Palestinians would be the regional governments, the Arab countries, the Palestinians or their fellow Arabs, and of course the Muslim world, and to some extent one would expect the Christian world as well to not particularly appreciate the way the Zionists are committing genocide against Christians in the traditional home of Christianity. But none of those governments, with a very few exceptions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them, have been doing anything to try to stand up for the Palestinians. And they mostly have, in the past, pretended to be, you know, they give lip service, and every now and then one of them has actually helped out the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein did that in Iraq. Muammar Gaddafi did that in Libya, and then they paid the price. And I think the other leaders in the region sort of got the message that the Zionist-controlled West is going to come in and make your life miserable unless you dance to their tune. And so the people of the region, as we saw in the World Cup, are completely opposed to Zionism and virtually unanimous in their ardent desire for the liberation of Palestine. But most of the leaders in the region are not in line with that because they find it's more in their interest to play ball with the world's biggest powers. And what will make that change, I don't know. Maybe as the Palestinian Palestinian resistance becomes more popular worldwide, including here in the West, even in the Jewish communities of the West, the younger people tend to be more sympathetic to Palestinians. And as the people in the region put pressure on their governments, maybe that will bring some change.
Mr. Al-Assad, what do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression and provocations, especially the recent storming of Al-Aqsa by the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir? Why now?
Because, unfortunately, the rulers, the so-called Muslim rulers, are complicit in these aggressions that are being taken in Al-Aqsa Mosque, desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing the Palestinians. Four Palestinian children have been killed since the onset of this new year. We saw that the Arab monarchs, the Persian Gulf monarchs, are normalizing ties with the Zionists, shamefully normalizing ties with this occupation, and doing nothing to the Palestinians. They said that the so-called Abraham Accords will bring peace and justice for the Palestinians. We haven't seen this justice. The only thing, as I have mentioned earlier, that will bring justice for the Palestinians is the armed resistance. The armed resistance is the key for freeing the Palestinians and supporting them. And as we are marking in these days the martyrdom of Hashem Qasem Soleimani has done what the Palestinians deserve and what do better for the Palestinians, which is supporting the armed resistance and helping those resistance factions. And this what happened in the recent years. We have seen that while the Arab governments and Morocco have moved into normalization, the Palestinian units are getting closer to each other and uniting their efforts against this aggression. And I believe that the more the aggressive the Zionists will be, the more our resistance will unite and will bring this illegitimate entity into its immediate and eventual collapse.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Kevin Barrett, our Ramallah correspondent, has said to us many times that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time, and that any attempt to change the mosque status quo will explode the existing tensions. How important is it for the status quo of Al-Aqsa to remain intact, and what repercussions would there be if that's not the case?
Well, that's right. There's been a kind of a tenuous peace. I guess peace isn't maybe quite the right word for it, given the ongoing slow-motion genocide of Palestine. But we haven't seen a kind of third world war along religious lines break out, in part because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which again is the Islamic world's oldest and greatest architectural monument and the spiritual symbol of the universality of the Islamic message, as the symbol of the Miraj of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, who encountered all of the other prophets, including the founding prophets of Christianity and Judaism, as he ascended into the nearness of God, that great symbol and that great monument means everything to the Muslims. And the Zionists have a kind of a millenarian messianic mythology that spun off into outright Satanism with Shabtai Zvi in 1666. And those Satanists who have spun off from Judaism and Zionism are dedicated to bringing their false Messiah, their Dajjal or Antichrist, to rule the world by destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and building a blood sacrifice temple from which the world will be ruled. This is this bizarre millenarian messianic mythology that the ultra-Zionists, and perhaps including Ben-Gavir and his friends, believe in. So keeping the inviolability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is absolutely paramount in terms of preventing massive global bloodshed if the Zionists do decide to either try to destroy or to take over a portion of this mosque, which Ben-Gavir has announced his intention to do. It's a huge issue, and this is the kind of issue that at least should be talked about honestly in the United Nations, but it hasn't been, and the world's biggest powers have every reason not to want some kind of huge explosion there that could destabilize the world and interfere with their own interests even. Have been slow to talk about this and to try to find a solution to it, because the Zionists, again, they have so much power, and for the Zionists that control the Western media, that dominate Western finance, even though most of them are not Ben-Gavirs themselves, are not that fanatically attached to destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and putting up a blood sacrifice temple to usher in the reign of the Antichrist, a few of them probably are, but most of them aren't, but they still have this mentality that Jewish interests can do no wrong. And so they won't let the Western governments do anything about this.
Ms. Al-Assad, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a weekend. To name one instance, there was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to the Nafa prison with the aim of harassing the Palestinian prisoners there. Hamas has, of course, responded to that. It's called this an unprecedented criminal act, adding that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation that our people will not let it go unnoticed. Are the Israelis, with this new far-right cabinet at its helm, in search of escalating tensions, in your opinion?
I believe that this reckless actions, unfortunately, the Zionists don't learn lessons from their previous experiences. We have seen what happened last May, during Saif al-Aqsa operations. Unfortunately, they don't learn lessons that as long as they insist in desecrating our holy places and killing our people and murdering our people, their option to resistance became more substantial and more, and it's the only key to put an end for these aggressions. I believe that the Muslim population across the globe, especially here in West Asia, must pressure their governments. They must use the alternative media to expose these violations, and to work hard to support the Palestinians, and also the Palestinians must unite, exert all the possible efforts in order to put an end for these aggressions. I don't believe that the Zionists take these measures in order to risk to provocate the Palestinians, but the Palestinians will respond, and this is their right to respond and to resist these aggressions.
Kevin Barrett, the office of the new Israeli Prime Minister has just announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in response to their appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime will also impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction as well. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions?
Well, they're trying to punish the Palestinian Authority for in this case, doing the right thing, going to the International Criminal Court, Court of Justice, and trying to get some justice for some of these crimes that have been committed against them. And, of course, the old saying is no good deed goes unpunished. And so the Zionists are punishing the Palestinian Authority for doing something right. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority has done wrong things as well, and it has made too many accommodations with Zionist power. The Zionists think they own the Palestinian Authority, and to some extent they have. They've had a lot of influence over it in the past, at certain points at least. But now I guess they're trying to rein it in, and they're saying, well, if you give in to popular opinion and press these war crimes charges against us, then we will do what we can to make your life more difficult. So that's the sort of thing the Zionists always do. They're always finding ways to retaliate against anyone that's either done something to them or that they imagine has done something to them. And so this actually, it could be a good thing if the Palestinian leaders realize that it's time to stop dealing with the Zionists. Alan Hart, the former BBC lead correspondent for the for Israel-Palestine, personal friend of Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, used to say in the last years of his life that the Palestinian Authority really should dissolve itself, and that would make the Israeli occupier 100% responsible for everything happening in the occupied territories, and that would put the ball in the next court. And maybe it's time for the Palestinians to do that. But in any case, this will force the PA closer to the views of the majority of their people.
And Ms. Al-Assad, Hamas has pledged to defend Al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its actions. The PA has said before that any aggression against Al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Now, Russia's UN envoy in the recent Security Council session recounted the events that took place back in the year 2000 after Ariel Sharon stormed Al-Aqsa, sparking the second Palestinian intifada. Analysts and observers say we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. How do you see it?
The entire axis of resistance has actually warned against another intifada, because as we have mentioned, that the Zionist occupation is manifesting on a daily basis its aggressive hostilities against the Palestinians, against our holy places, murdering Palestinian minors, women, and without full impunity, because the Zionist occupation knows that no one will hold them accountable. And as we see that as I've mentioned, that the Persian Gulf monarchies are turning deaf ears and blind eyes to these aggressions and getting closer to the Zionist enemy. And we see that